Let's start by telling you the reason I picked the name Building Networks from Networks is to draw attention to an ambiguity from the get-go, which is that I work with data networks, and I work with networks as abstract graphs derived from those networks. And it is nearly impossible to explain that coherently within the space of a single paper. So every thing I ever submit always has one reviewer confused what kind of network I mean somewhere. So if at any point I confuse any of you, please stop, interrupt me, and I'll clarify exactly what I'm talking about. And I've subtitled this, Mining Network Data to Model User Behavior. So basically, what I'm interested in doing is taking very large volumes of data from what people are actually doing on the internet and figuring out ways of typifying their typical behavior that they go through when they're actually using the network, which is what controls how the network needs to respond to them. So as a personal introduction, here's where I fit in the grand scheme of the Complex Systems Group at Indiana University. I'm a PhD candidate there studying computer science, majoring in artificial intelligence and data networks, which is probably not the most common confluence. So I work with Filippo Menzer. Some of you... there's Phil right there. Some of you may know him. And I also, this is my other hat that I wear. I work with an organization at Indiana University called the Advanced Network Management Laboratory. And essentially what we are is a research group that seeks out collaborations to do with people all over the place, just doing interesting network management applications having to do with data networks. We have, at Indiana University is the manager of a number of very large international networks, so we have access to a wide variety of network data sources. So we like to seek out collaborations with people who are anxious to apply some analysis algorithms to extremely large data sets. The focus of my research in particular is analyzing large-scale behavioral data and modeling user behavior. Specifically, I'm interested in applications that have to do with network security, application design, and search engines that derive from that, which leads to a number of personal tastes, which is sort of what, if in network research you can regard somebody as having a religious orientation in research, it's among some of these lines. I prefer to have a fuzzy, real-valued measures whenever I can. I'm not very interested in doing binary classification sort of things because all of my data sources are noisy enough so that very rigid black and white distinctions are essentially not very meaningful. Sorry, I meant to go the other way. I am also interested in designing systems for network management that focus as much as possible on reducing the need for expert opinion and knowledge as input to the system. I like to derive everything from the raw data itself as much as possible. And the reason for this is, for one, my applications in network security is such a quickly moving field that anything that is designed on expert input is necessarily completely reactive in character. There are far more bad guys out there with time on their hands and willingness to work for free than there are highly paid information security professionals out there. So it's a target that's moving too rapidly to address simply with expert knowledge. I also try to avoid highly designed systems for the same reason. If you're introducing a lot of very specific domain knowledge into a system, then if something qualitatively changes with the information you're trying to deal with, that's very hard to react to. You've already got so many assumptions about what you expect to see built into your design, it's very difficult to adapt. And for that reason, I think that talking to people in a variety of fields is very useful, because all the systems I design, I try and incorporate not assumptions about data networks specifically, but about network analysis in general as much as I can. So to try and tie in what I'll be talking about with this workshop as a whole, what I'm really talking about is how structural data mining, that is analyzing structural properties of graphs, can allow us to infer aspects of user behavior. And so what I mean by structural data mining is really statistical properties of graph structures. So specifically I'm interested in going from data sources that generate very long lists of events that have been triggered by some process or individual, something like that, to understanding large-scale properties of the behavior of some population, which has applications wherever being able to model user behavior can help to design a system, make it safer, make it more robust, or whatever else. Specifically, I'm very interested in talking to mathematicians because you may know that sociologists first developed a lot of the metrics and interesting statistics that people look at with these kind of behavioral networks. The problem is that their data sets are small enough so that a lot of their statistics have been developed without much regard to complexity. So the data sources I'll be talking to you about, I often have graphs with, say, 10 million nodes or 100 million nodes, which are completely computationally intractable if we're talking about an algorithm that has n squared or higher running time. So specifically, I'm interested in talking to mathematicians because you may have ideas for heuristics that can approximate some of the more interesting statistics out there, or possibly just other things you have a good sense of what's computationally tractable, and ideas for accelerating some of these algorithms, perhaps. What I'm also interested in doing is increasing community knowledge out there of the available data sets. Very large graph-based data sets are hard to come by, not least because they've got very large storage requirements. They're difficult to move from place to place. People tend to guard their data sets. But Internet 2 is designed for research partnerships, and the Advanced Network Management Lab invites collaborative projects as part of our reason for being. So this is also a pitch to let you know that we'd love to share. Now, I am myself not a pure mathematician or an expert statistician. I have an undergraduate degree in math, but haven't gone on with that since there. But I do have a lot of experience in managing analysis of very large data sets like I'm going to be talking about. So for each one of these data sets, I really want to emphasize three primary aspects of it: how we gather it, how we anonymize it to protect user privacy, and how we reduce it to a tractable form. And the first data set I'll be talking about involves network flow data. And what I mean by network in this case is a data network. So my collaborators here are Filippo Menzer, who he works with largely with various projects related to analysis of the web. He's got some projects going on with shared bookmark systems, directed crawling, especially integrating content and link similarity and improving web search. And actually, if you're attending this whole series of workshops, I believe he'll be speaking at the third workshop. Alessandro Vespignani is a physicist by trade initially. He's in our complex systems group, co-authored a book on the structure and evolution of the physical internet, and is now doing a lot of work on epidemiology in networks, specifically how you can relate some ideas about how diseases spread through human populations and how viruses spread on the internet. So, to talk about network flow data, first I'd like to make it very clear exactly what kind of data I'm talking about, where it comes from, how to process it into a usable form, and then most importantly, what can it tell you, or at least what has it told us so far that's interesting to say about the internet as a whole. So I don't know what people's background with data networks is, so this is a sort of very low-level basic introduction trying to give you an intuition about what exactly is involved with the network flow. So our scenario that I'll be working on here is there's some web surfer out there named Buddy, and he wants to just go to a web page to visit information about his favorite band that's hosted on some website in the network. So he just knows that there is some big abstract thing between him and a web server called the network. Well, in order to for him to contact a web page, there needs to be some sort of virtual connection between those two computers established through the network. So in order to establish a connection between two computers, of course, they need to have some way of identifying one another. So what we use in the internet are these numeric IP addresses, where each computer has at least one, certainly. And so Buddy's computer and the Vulgar Entertainment web server will be able to know one another by using these numeric addresses. That's not enough to identify this conversation uniquely, because there are a lot of different ways in which any computer on the internet can talk to one another. So there could potentially be many connections in the network between these two computers, which means that you need additional abstraction to identify any particular conversation, which is a port number. So, back up one here, actually. So, as soon as we introduce port numbers, we need to actually sort of make this connection a little bit more asymmetric than it might seem it needs to be. We're going to identify one computer as a client, one computer as a server. Now, these terms are almost as badly over-defined in computer science literature as networks are in general. But what they mean in the context here is that a client is going to be somebody on the network who initiates a conversation, and the server is going to be somebody who is on the network waiting for a conversation to be started with it. And the reason that's important is when we are trying to set up a new conversation, Buddy's computer is going to pick some port number just completely out of the blue because it doesn't matter what he uses. But he needs to know basically what door to knock on to get into a web server to talk to it. And it turns out that web servers use port 80 because that's something that everybody has already agreed on in advance. So this server out here, like all other web servers, is just sitting there waiting for some other computer to contact it on port 80. And it will use some other number on its end that is just made up that serves only to basically serve a way of talking back. So when we're finally ready to set up a conversation, what would happen is that Buddy's computer basically sends a hello message over to this web server. It will respond with other information needed to get that connection started. And from then on, there is a virtual path in the network that may involve many steps and all kinds of other complexities here in the middle. But at least to the end computers, it just looks like there is a direct connection now between these two end systems. So what a network flow is then, and for some reason this slide is not showing up. Oh, there we go. What a network flow then is this conversation that we've seen set up between this client computer and a web server can actually be thought of as two flows. A flow is a directional transmission of some volume of information on the network over some period of time. So there's one flow that's involved that's all of the data that goes from this client to the server. There's another flow of information from the server back to the client. So every individual conversation is actually going to involve two flows. Now the important thing about flows is that they give you a way of summarizing some conversation that's happened on the network without actually containing any of the conversation itself. So there's no, when we're talking about flow data, we're not talking about what anybody has said. We're simply talking about who they've said it to, when they said it, perhaps how long they said it, and some other attributes, but we're never going to actually look at somebody's conversation itself. So this gives us a way of taking a look at user behavior without directly spying what people are saying. We want to respect privacy as much as we can. Now, if you take a look at the definition of the most common kind of flow record, there's just a whole wealth of information here, though, as I said, there's no actual user data contained in there in the sense that there's no, like, what web page somebody requested is not part of this. There are some interesting features to point out. One is that we have access in one of these flow records to both how many packets and how many octets, which is gives you basically two measures of the size of a conversation. One is how many messages were there, and the other is what was the total length of everything that was said. Those are actually can be fairly distinct quantities depending on what kind of bad behavior somebody is doing on the network. So it's useful to have information on both of those fields there. Another interesting bit of information is that if you're familiar with TCP, which is used for connection-oriented connections on the internet, you get a cumulative OR of the TCP flags, which gives you information for basically categorizing flows in a lot of interesting ways, depending on whether you can basically detect that some things are anomalous behavior that are not legitimate conversations and filter them out of the data set. So this gives you the chance to filter out a lot of noise from the data set. this information about protocol is very important for distinguishing certain kinds of network conversation. Now, when we present this data set to a lot of people, initially they are very excited to see that this TOS information is here. That stands for a type of service, which is supposed to work in support of differentiated services on the internet. The original vision is that people who are applying for, who are paying for some sort of premium network service have a different value there, so their traffic gets priority and so forth. This actually turns out not to be useful information anywhere that we know of, because a user can simply set that by itself. So no network internal to the internet is going to pay attention to what anybody else has ever set their type of service information to, because it's basically an attempt to game the system by and large. Now, one other bit of very important information that people might be interested in is this source AS and destination AS, which AS here stands for autonomous system. So if you've ever heard the internet described as a network of networks, the networks that are hooked up together are these autonomous systems. What it essentially means is some very large administrative entity inside the internet. For example, I'm sure that UCLA has its own AS number, as does Indiana University. So it basically, it reflects some subsection of the internet that is on some one organization's administrative control. So this gives you a powerful way of aggregating this flow of information to try and make it more tractable, if that's a resolution at which the data would be useful for whatever you're doing. Because one thing is that this can automatically be used in a sense to make things more tractable, because the width of this field is such that the internet, without changing all the routing protocols and everything, can have only 2 to the 16th AS numbers. So this is guaranteed never to fill up more than 65,000.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Could you tell us again the difference between packets and octets?
Okay, so a packet is essentially one parcel of information that's going out over the network. So a packet may contain some variable amount of information. So basically, if you have a reliable connection between two computers, it will be sent as a continuous, as a set of these packets, each of which contains some number of octets that contribute to the total conversation. So packets will always be less than octets. The reason it's interesting is that an application can sometimes be characterized by how small its messages are. If, say, you're logged into somewhere with Telnet or SSH or something like that, and you're typing at a keyboard, those messages will typically be very small because you want a very interactive response. If you're downloading a large file from somewhere, those packets will probably be very large.
So who collects this data and how long do they keep it?
Well, actually, that's what I'll be getting into just next, actually. So now we get into where this data comes from. And where it comes from is internet routers. This is a just a picture of one common bit of Cisco equipment. And the reason that we are able to actually even collect flow data is a little bit of a historical accident. And data networks have always run at speeds much faster than people's personal computers, and that's still the case. So your modern high-speed data networks are running at 10 gigabits a second or 100 gigabits a second, very fast speeds that your desktop PC can't even possibly fill the wire. So what the router manufacturers have done is essentially all of the routers that run the internet are multiprocessing systems where everything is happening as much as possible on these line cards that are plugged into the chassis as possible. So one side effect of that is they need to keep information directly on these cards for what conversations on the network they're handling right now. So what it turns out is that basically corresponds to this flow information. And one day, a bright engineer at Cisco decided, you know what, instead of just clearing out this information every so often, why don't we make it so that we can send that data somewhere, and hey, maybe some network engineer somewhere is interested in it. And it turned out that, yes, people were very interested in it. Now it's a dominant standard. Now, having hyped up everything that this data can be good for is where I'm going to start tearing that down a little bit for. And this is taken from Cisco's technical literature, some of the information about sampling. And that's basically the bad news, is that this data has to be sampled. The flow of data in a modern network is so great that typically only about 1 in 100 packets can go into making up this data at all. What is worse is that sampling methods also vary from vendor to vendor, from version of operating system a router is running to another. So sometimes if you're lucky, the equipment you have access to is doing random sampling, which is good because if it's doing some sort of fixed time slice sampling, then there are a lot of very rhythmic activities in the network. You're going to systematically undersample some things, oversample others. So there's a lot of potential biases just from the sampling. Then there's the additional bad news that your chance of sampling a packet may be dependent on what kind of packet it is. And the reason for that is actually based on this architecture again. There are some kinds of network conversation that are very routine and easy for a router to deal with. Like, if you just turn on your computer and go to a web server, that's a very typical conversation. If you're doing some sort of interesting network measurement or something like that, you're generating basically more oddball things. And those packets aren't actually able to be processed in one of these cards. They have to go to a main CPU that runs at slower conventional computer speeds. And they take a lot longer to process. And again, depending on the vendor, you may be either more likely to see those conversations in your network flows or less likely. There's also a varying definition from vendor to vendor on what exactly is meant by a flow. Now, the reason it seems pretty concrete from what I've said so far, but we have the problem that a router only has so much memory and can only keep track of so many conversations at one time. So there has to be some sort of timeout for a very long conversation where it will just be repeated every so often as this is something that's still ongoing. There is also not every conversation in the network is connection oriented. You can just send a message from point A to point B without much concern whether it actually gets there because nobody's going to answer back. And so basically a router has to decide for itself when a set of messages that are related have ended and it's time to consider that a finished conversation to move on. In addition, if you've heard of IPv6, which is supposedly the next generation of the internet protocol, everything that works with flows basically doesn't work with IPv6 right now, which is fine for right now because it's not very widely deployed yet and may never be. So now getting to where this exactly who's taking this data and where it comes from. We get our flow data from the Internet to Abilene Network, which is, I've pictured a slightly older view of it here. But this is the data network that is connecting about 200 universities and research networks in the US. So it provides transit between universities all over the country. It also provides some international service from networks in East Asia to Western Europe and back again. It also provides, for some schools, access to the commercial internet with peering arrangements with some commercial providers. So basically, the cumulative user base here is, nobody knows exactly, but in the neighborhood of a few million users. Now, when it comes to retaining this data and making it available, Internet 2 is very concerned about user privacy, even of flow information that doesn't include anybody's actual conversation contents. And so there are anonymization rules for how this data can be used, which basically mean that these flow data that we collect can never be connected back again to anybody's individual IP address on the network. So some anonymization has to take place, or we're not allowed to actually let this data touch a disk. Now, once it has been anonymized, it can be retained indefinitely under their guidelines. Now, there's a couple of reasons why this network is a particularly good source of data to work with for this kind of behavioral information. First is that it's never been full. So this network has never been full of capacity. It's instrumented for research, which means that at every one of these core nodes you see here, there is a data center that has a number of multipurpose PCs that are specifically there just for people to do some sort of network management projects. And most importantly, it's also a transit network rather than an edge network. In other words, it doesn't generate or sync its own traffic. It's carrying messages for other people, which removes just a huge source of bias that is present in almost all institutional networks that you'd be finding at the edge of it. So you've got a very heterogeneous mixture of traffic on it, especially the user base is essentially dominated by over 1 million American undergraduates who are, let's just say, early adopters of new internet technologies. So as far as how we actually process that then, well, the traditional view of in network security circles has been that I showed you the structure of what one of these flow records look like. What they typically do is load it into a large relational database and just treat every one of these flows as one more row in one of those tables. Well, there's a problem with that, and that's that it tends to get people thinking in terms of detecting that there's some problem on the network or some bit of malfeasance or something like that as a matter of some amount of traffic rising over a threshold. And the problem with that is that thresholds are really for well-behaved distributions. And I'll get to what I mean by that a little bit later. And there's another problem that there's a lot of information in the relationships among these computers. So for example, suppose that we've identified some computer on the network that we know has been hacked into somebody, it's trying to pull down web services, it's hacking people all over the place. And suppose that we can see from the network traffic there's another computer it's got a very close relationship with. If we can identify some other computer that shares the same kind of relationship, then that might be something that ought to be looked at. Or suppose that we found some computer that is generating attacks on the network, and we find another computer that isn't generating attacks yet, but its pattern of talking to other computers is so similar that we may be able to conclude that this is something that is suspicious. Maybe somebody should be looking at whether this system will be used in the future as a source of an attack. And so what I'm interested in doing is treating this information not as rows in a relational database, but as information from which we can build up a graph structure and analyze properties of that graph structure. And the reason for that is that I feel that behavior is an idea that lends itself very naturally to a graph structure. What you're getting with a threshold or this relational model is essentially statements like computer X said 10,000 words today. And that does not really give you interesting information nearly as much as, say, X said 5,000 words to person A and 5,000 words to person B, or X said one word to each of 10,000 different people. Those are very different behaviors, and you really need this sort of graph structure to characterize that kind of information. So how we gather this data is it comes to our setup as a large flood from the Abilene network doing this 1 in 100 random packet sampling. So it comes to our flow collector where we have to do this anonymization before it hits a disk. Now there are several different variations of anonymization that we're allowed to do under the Abilene agreements. What we do is we make basically a one-way index where over the course of a day, host number 75 is just the 75th computer on the internet we happen to get any information about today. And then at the end of the day, we'll throw out that index and start all over again. So this means that once a day of data has been collected, we have no way of going back again and trying to figure out what computer that was. We have no way of injecting traffic into the network after a day is done to try and recover that identity. So any individual computer will maintain its identity over a day, but we don't have more long-term information than that. Now, what comes up a lot when we explain this data set then is people would like to know, why not just put everything through a one-way hash? And the answer for that is simply that these addresses aren't long enough to prevent exhaustive search of the key space. So that really wouldn't afford anybody additional privacy. So to give you a rough idea of the data dimensions, just taking a look at when we were doing some of our initial collections a couple of years ago, Abilene on April 14th, 2005 exchanged about 200 terabytes of data, which corresponds to about 25,000 DVDs. We got 600 million of these flow records out of that, which takes about 30 gigabytes of disk storage just for this raw information and involves about 15 million hosts. Now, this information, when I say something like 15 million hosts, is going to be approximate because we don't really know how many hosts there are on Abilene. Some of these hosts are lying. They are making up their addresses. They are scanning things that computers they don't necessarily know are there. So almost all the numbers I'm going to tell you are at least fuzzy to some extent because almost all internet data can be spoofed by somebody who's trying to do something or other that's bad. But our fundamental assumption then, in trying to put all this information together, is that a flow represents an edge in a graph. There is one computer talking to another computer with some magnitude of information that can be used to weight the edges in the graph. And there we also have information about when a conversation started and stopped that can be used for some sort of dynamic analysis or aggregation or whatever else. And what we then do with all that information is put it into a weighted bipartite digraph representation. So when we develop one of these graphs of behavioral data, every edge in our network is from a server to a client or from a client to a server then. Now, flows do not necessarily identify what is a client, what is a server. So we have to guess that for ourselves by applying some heuristics. If you remember earlier, I said that all web servers live on port 80. So that means that whoever's talking on port 80 is probably a server. It means that any individual computer on the network could fit in possibly both of these categories, depending on how it's configured and behaves. So there is some overlap between them. And that overlap in itself can be interesting to study. For example, if you think about peer-to-peer networks, where the idea is that everybody on the network is the same, there are a lot of systems that show up in both the client and server categories there. Turns out if you look at the World Wide Web, it's very uncommon for some system that's hosting web pages to also have somebody who uses that computer to browse other web pages. And the question may be, why go to the complexity of having this be a bipartite graph as opposed to just having host to hosts? And the reason for that is that a lot of network protocols are very highly asymmetric, and you would actually lose a lot of information by just conflating these together. For example, when you surf the web, you're actually transmitting very little information in general, but you're pulling a lot of information down from web servers, even though you're both involved with the web. What we can do then also is generate multiple versions of this graph depending on what application we think is being involved. So, example, we can come up with a graph that involves interaction among all hosts that are dealing with the web, all hosts that are dealing with Metallo, which is a popular file sharing program, and so forth. So the question is then what sort of things can this information tell you? And I'll give you an idea of some of the things we've started to do with this data. If we take a look at just network applications in general, we can basically, in the network today, there are three big broad categories of traffic. There's the World Wide Web, there's file sharing applications, and then there's everything else. This is as a percentage of the total number of flows we see in a single day. If we did it by the total volume of conversation, you would see this file sharing chunk grow to be a much larger slice of the pie, actually. So when we take a look at one of these networks, the most basic distributions we're interested in taking a look at are, for any node, we can define the in degree as the number of systems that have been sending data to that host, the in strength being the sum of all of the weights of those incoming edges. And similarly, we define out degree as the number of nodes that are at the head of some outgoing edge in that node, and the out strength then is the sum of all these weights. So in strength is how much data has gone to a computer on the internet. Out strength is how much data has come out of that computer. And if we take a look at these distributions, we actually start to see some very surprising things. Now, there's a number of features. This is a lot of information in very little time. Some features I'd like to point out is that these are are estimates of the probability density functions for the distributions of degree and strength for the three classes of traffic I just showed you, the World Wide Web, peer-to-peer applications, and everything put together. So the first thing to notice is that we are dealing with over 10 orders of magnitude here for the scale on the x-axis on these graphs. So these are very, very long, long-tailed distributions. We also see things that are the reason why we are so skeptical of the utility of any of this kind of threshold-based measures for determining a taxonomy network and so forth, which is that if you take a look at these distributions for web clients and servers for either degree or strength, for the clients here we see this line here is an estimate of fitting this to a power law with exponent about 2.4 here, 2.1 here. The fact that the exponent of this power law fit is between 2 and 3 means that this distribution actually has unbounded variance. So that's telling us that this distribution has such a wide tail that we're losing any idea of there being a characteristic scale here. And even worse, when we take a look at what's happening for web servers, is we've got 1.8 and 1.7 here for a power law estimate of the fit with a pretty good linear fit on a log-log scale. What this exponent means is that the system doesn't even have any bounded mean. So essentially, a threshold becomes completely meaningless because it's not a meaningful statement anymore to even say, well, your typical web server handles this much data in a day. There is no such thing as a typical web server. There's no number you could pull out of your head that's within the limits of the size of the data set that's not something that you would be perfectly okay seeing a web server doing. They basically come in all shapes and sizes, out as many orders of magnitude as you can imagine, as if you're willing to collect data for longer, you still have to get points out here. So there's not really, these aren't intrinsic values to the system, so a threshold doesn't really do you much good. Where here do you draw a line for where there should be a cutoff?
Yes. So in the case of servers, and I can imagine that there are hubs and so forth, so therefore there are the huge, you know, servers which have a huge number of degrees and strengths and so forth. But in terms of clients, there are, you know, small number, but they have, some clients have a huge number of degrees and strengths. And those are, who are those clients?
Okay, so the question is, boy, even the client graph goes all the way out here past 10 to the 5th different servers contacted. So in some cases, that's going to be web crawlers out there.
I see.
And that's naturally what we'd expect. Now, because this is anonymized data, we can't go back and necessarily verify this on our own. But you would expect them to be crawlers. On the other hand, you still see a very smooth continuum here.
Right.
So there must be something that's sort of a beast somewhere between a regular surfer
and
a web crawler. They sort of blend into one another.
Yeah.
There's never any place where there's a clear cutoff between two different classes of behavior. And one thing we notice that peer-to-peer traffic is very different in that it doesn't have a very good power law fit at all, and clients and servers act so similarly there's no point in showing them as being different. The reason we think we see that is that most of the systems on here are not dedicated computers whose only purpose is to be on peer-to-peer networks. They are people with their PCs at home sharing movies, and those computers only have so much capacity. So, you know, the PC on your desk can't be responsible for as much traffic as a web server that's way out here. So I'm going to actually skip past a little bit of this information in the interest of time, and talk on application correlation, which I think relates very closely to some of what we've talked about so far with trying to develop ontologies and hierarchies of things based on basically automated data analysis. And so what we mean by application correlation is trying to figure out some way of creating a taxonomy of internet applications as based on the behavior we see from them in the wild. So we're not trying to categorize applications based on expert information. We're trying to categorize them and say how they relate to one another based on what they look like and how they affect networks. So the way we do this is to just consider the outstrength of a client in two different versions of this network. We're going to have two ports in mind. So these are going to, I'm using port here as a synonym for application. So we're going to consider how much, basically how much data a single client has, say, transmitted on the web, and how much information a single client has transmitted on, say, BitTorrent, a peer-to-peer application. We then create two vectors based on that information for every single client we've seen on the network. So each application now becomes a point in basically 15 million dimensional space, where each coordinate is telling us how much information one particular computer on the network has sent out using that application. So we've got this collection of points now, one vector for every application that is pointing in some direction in this very high dimensional space. So what we then do is take a look at the cosine similarity of those vectors. Now obviously there's a lot of different similarity measures we could use. The reason we're picking cosine similarity is simply because it's tractable for a large data set, and as much as possible we'd like to be able to do all these kinds of analysis in real time. So when our cosine similarity is zero, then we have the case that these applications are never used together at the same time. If the similarity is one, they're always used at the same time, and they're always used to the exact same extent as measured by how much traffic a computer generates. If we then take those similarities, basically just convert them into distances by adding some small epsilon, taking the reciprocal, then we get a distance measure. We can apply, we used Ward's hierarchical clustering. We could use any number, one of a number of clustering algorithms. We can then develop, basically we develop a hierarchy of applications now. With this matrix is showing basically these raw similarity scores between pairs of applications.
How did you make that?
Well, we ordered this by
hand.
We ordered this by hand, staying consistent to the dendrogram, which is,
okay.
So the dendrogram is completely automatically generated. We then hand ordered the matrix as permitted by the dendrogram. So what we were able to do then is we can really see from this, we were able to come up with some broad clusters of application, which is these ones that are in pink here are basically representing peer-to-peer sort of things. These heavy bars here, where these ports are associated with nearly everything, that's the World Wide Web. The web is so ubiquitous to every computer on the network that it's highly related to everything. And then these blue ones here are really the very traditional kind of client-server applications. Well, so that's sort of a big deal. Is that good for anything? Well, what we then did was we took a few ports that we had really no idea what kind of application that corresponded to. Either it's something so obscure that we couldn't believe anybody was actually using that, or it's not a registered application. Who knows what that is? So this one up here, it's right next to FTP, port number 388. We discovered that in fact is almost the same as FTP. It's actually used by meteorologists to exchange very large bodies of weather data from point to point. So there it is, right in there with FTP. The one that gave us a lot of heart then was we had this 19,101, which we had no idea what that was. We looked at just the IU network and weren't seeing much traffic on it, so we were doubly perplexed. But it seems to be right in here with things like ICQ, which is a sort of a peer-to-peer conversation, and Nutella, which is file sharing. So we were eventually able to figure out, based on the fact that it was grouped with these peer-to-peer applications, this is a Korean language file sharing application that was being routed across Abilene to users in Europe who like to download anime shows and complete seasons of Chinese and Japanese and Korean TV shows. So even if we had been nosy and looked into everybody's conversations, we wouldn't have been able to make head or tail of anything in those packets, none of us knowing Korean. However, because of this taxonomy, we're at least able to see that it has is some sort of peer-to-peer application, and because of that, it's probably going to scale the same way other peer-to-peer applications do and affect the network in similar ways.
So those, you know, peer-to-peer applications, like, you know, pink ones in the bottom,
yes.
And then some, like, those Kazaa and so forth, in the upper portion, why didn't they basically come together?
Yeah, so not all the peer-to-peer applications came together, and it's kind of complicated. It's related to some of the differences among the peer-to-peer applications. One reason is that the ones up here are sort of lower traffic peer-to-peer applications that are on their way down.
I see.
And those generally also have the property that they are connected more and more with hacked systems and things that basically sources of malicious network traffic, which is actually why you sort of get this relation in here to, you see SQL Server and eDonkey are actually closely paired to one another. Even though SQL Server is very much a traditional client-server application, eDonkey is file sharing. The reason they're together is because SQL Server data isn't even routed over Abilene legitimately. Almost every single university blocks that at their border. If you're seeing SQL Server out there, it's because somebody is trying to hack somebody else's system. And the people who use peer-to-peer applications are particularly likely to be able to, or be trying to hack each other's computers. Okay, so running on time, but I'll head in to show you what I can of the second data set I wanted to bring up, which is we're taking a look now at applying some of the same techniques to web click data, which is basically taking a look at the connection between Indiana University's network and the rest of the world, which occurs at a point called the Indiana Gigapop. So Indiana University has over 100,000 people located at 8 branch campuses, and we are able to take a look at this network connection between IU and the rest of the world as long as we take care to anonymize the data carefully. And in this case, we're applying an even stricter definition of anonymization because we really want to be careful about protecting user privacy in this case. In this case, we mean we're not going to retain information of any kind about client identity. We're not going to generate a unique index. We're not going to even go that far. We're just going to record that somebody clicked on a link at some point in time. And theoretically, it could be one person who generated all this web traffic, or it could be everybody together at IU. We don't know. We're deliberately throwing that information away so that we cannot trace this traffic back to any individual. And so what we do is we actually have a computer that is taking a look at all the traffic inbound and outbound from Indiana University. And we're taking a look at every web request packet we can identify and trying to glean a few key bits of information from it. First, we're just asking whether the client is inside the IU network. So we're interested in finding out whether it's somebody at IU surfing the outside world or somebody from the outside world surfing IU. And that's simply so that we can filter out the outside traffic that's surfing sites at IU, because that's, you know, IU web space is not very representative of the World Wide Web as a whole. We're interested in what URL is being requested. The reason we're interested in the specific URL that somebody is looking for is that it's very important to find out what kind of data object somebody wants to get. It turns out that for every page somebody fetches, there may be 10 to 20 other requests generated for inline images, style sheets, all these other things. So we want to really know when somebody is specifically asking for a web page. That's the interesting thing. We're also interested in trying to figure out whether somebody is a browser or a bot. Now, we don't retain just, there's actually a user agent string that shows up in all these requests. We don't retain that because we found that in the wild we can expect to see well over 50,000 different user agents over the course of a day. And the reason for that is that browsers have all kinds of different ways of announcing what they are. For example, Internet Explorer will even identify exactly what patch level of the browser you're running. So, you know, a malicious web server can certainly use that information. But we just try and guess whether we're talking about somebody using a browser or this is somebody's program that's just out there, a bot that's actually out there scanning the web. And then this referrer information is what makes these clicks instead of just a list of pages that are being fetched, this is what lets us make them actual edges in the network. Whenever you go to a web page, you provide information to the target site on what page it is that you're coming to them from. Now, in a lot of cases, this information will be blank because, say, you fire up your browser, it goes to some start page automatically. In that case, there isn't any referrer. But if you click on a link that you see somewhere, your browser will automatically fill out this referrer field with where you came from. You're also telling the web server what individual host on that web server you're interested in talking to. This, in the early days of the web, it used to be one web server equals one website. Now it's common for one very large web server to host perhaps tens of thousands of different sites, and this information is used to basically specify which one. So we take all these requests and make an edge list out of them with a host index. Similar, just basically the same sort of process we went through with the flow data, where now every node is a web server. The wait from one node to another indicates how many times somebody followed a link from that server to that other server. So what we actually get out of that is a weighted subset of the actual host graph that represents the web. Now we're taking a look at this, the resolution of individual web servers rather than hosts, just in the interest of computational tractability and basically data storage space. So each one of these nodes represents a host, not a web page, but we have a weighted subset of the actual host-to-host graph of the web.
So are you throwing away the requests that don't have a referrer attached to them, the referrer header?
No, we do not throw. So the question is, do we throw away the edges that don't have a referrer? No, we actually have an imaginary node called the empty referrer, and we keep track of how many clicks there were from this imaginary empty referrer to any host. So, for example, some web server may have gotten half of its traffic from the empty referrer and half of it from assortment of other servers.
One other question. Each of the GET requests has an associated HTTP response code. Are you storing that as well?
We do not keep any HTTP response code because basically the data source is too large for us to actually follow a conversation into the second packet to take a look at the response. So we don't know how many of these are for failed requests or anything.
Yeah, well, a 302 or a 301 could be interesting as well because it's a redirect to another node.
Yeah, redirects would be great to get, but basically if we do enough stream reassembly to figure out what the response codes are, then our sampling rate goes way down. So we're dealing with about 800 megabits sustained traffic that we're looking at. So that gives you sort of an idea. We have to do a few regular expressions to pull this information out of the request. And we are able to achieve about 30% sampling during peak traffic.
Do you think if you have the information that would affect the structure of these graphs that you're creating?
Now, so the question is, if we were able to get these response codes, would it greatly affect the structure of the graph? Now, I can't say exactly. I think the answer would be that it would affect more greatly if we were taking a look at individual web pages, but individual web hosts I don't think would affect nearly as much because most redirects are going to be from a server to some other location on that same server. Or at least that's what I would argue.
Yeah, the theme of these questions I'm asking is about malicious traffic, and these redirects can be used to do search engine optimization, for instance, where you want to boost your rankings, or web anonymization, where you want to do a meta redirect to from one page to another to anonymize where you really came from.
Yes.
And that's what I'm curious about, how that would affect the structure.
Yes, and so basically, that's where we're essentially fortunate to be an academic institution that doesn't house any very important websites that people want to attack, and typically doesn't host a whole lot of attacks either. Basically, any system at IU that's taking part in some sort of distributed web attack is generally shut down fairly quickly, so we don't have a lot of malicious traffic represented in this data. If you were to apply our techniques to some other commercial transit network, absolutely, that would be a major, major problem. So, and this is a very large and growing data set. I'll try and wrap up quickly here. We've got well over 15 billion clicks logged so far, taking over a terabyte of disk space. So it's a lot to analyze. We discovered a number of very surprising things already in just our cursory analysis of this. Verified page requests are only about 7% of all the web requests that occur out there. Every time somebody retrieves a page, there's an average of about 10 additional requests. We find exactly the same sort of scaling problems we did. This is taking a look at the n degree of individual servers in this graph. So this is how many different servers had links to some particular server out there. So this is basically, if somebody's out here, then a server out here has, there are links from 10,000 other servers to that one that are generating traffic. And here's where we ran into one interesting problem, which is that the exponent we recover from here is very different from, well, not very different. We get about 2.3, 2.2. The literature, just based on crawling the web, estimates this at about 2.1 or so. So we're kind of curious, why are we finding a different topological property of the web that's actually used as opposed to the web that's crawled? And a very quick view of that is, so what we did then was take a look and compared our n degree of web hosts versus what we're able to find by asking Yahoo what their measure of the n degree of the site is. And this shows you that it's pretty messy, but to the extent we can find any sort of relationship, we find that there is some sort of systematic undersampling of very popular sites in the web. In other words, if a site is very popular, then we tend to undersample the number of incoming links to it, which sort of makes some intuitive sense because, for example, there are millions and millions of links out there to Microsoft.com, but nobody needs to follow one of those links to find Microsoft. Everybody knows they can just go to their location bar and type Microsoft.com and they'll get there. So essentially, our argument is that these very popular sites, each link to them is of less utility to users. Skip past that. And so one key thing we're interested in doing with this data is taking a look at how web data can be used to predict web data in the future. This is very important, for example, for web caching or traffic allocation or applications like that. So what we try and do is, we have this data chunked into hours, so we try and see how much does 1 hour of web data predict, say, the next hour in time? Or how much does this 1 hour of data predict 2 hours forward? So if we take a measure of precision recall here, so what I mean by precision recall in this context is, precision is going to, so in the context of a graph, we've got this weighted graph that represents an hour of data, we're going to predict that the next hour of data, say, is going to be exactly the same. So precision is going to be a matter of how many clicks that we predict are there that actually were there in the next hour of data over the number of total number of guesses we made. So every time that we successfully predict a click, that's going to contribute to our precision. Recall is going to be basically the same thing, except our denominator is going to be the number of clicks that actually happen. So it's basically taking a look at our coverage. How successfully do we predict all the traffic that happens? And they track each other very, very closely over our whole data set. What you find is that the ability to predict future network data drops very quickly after a few hours, then goes back up to a peak exactly 24 hours later, and then follows this very strong daily cycle until you start to actually do better again a week later in time. So all those 15 billion clicks can actually generate you a very smooth view of exactly how regular people's browsing patterns are.
Did you try normalizing away the 24-hour period so you get basically a...
No, we haven't normalized away the 24-hour period yet. So
it turns out, exactly the type of pattern you get with stock trading, for example. And the standard thing is you're supposed to normalize that away to get
another interesting feature of this is that the bottom of our lowest trough here is still well above 0.3. So there's essentially a very large body of web traffic that is occurring hour after hour, and you know, it doesn't matter how old the data is, you're still able to predict at least that well. If people are doing the same things on the web over and over again to just an extent that we never would have guessed. So what I really don't have time to go into a full explanation of, I'll just mention very quickly, is that our current direction in this research is to take a look at modifying, you may know the details of PageRank, which is basically a model of what the random web server does when faced with the web graph. And PageRank includes a number of assumptions about web servers, which is that, say, all links are equal, you can start anywhere, and that a random server may jump from one page to another. We're interested in taking a look at this data we have to come up with a more nuanced model of random servers, where it's not the case that all pages on the web are equally likely starting points for web servers. We have all this information about this empty referrer, and so pages that have a very high number of hits from an empty referrer are places where people are more likely to have started some web browsing session. It's also not the case that all links are created equal. There are some links on a page that people are much more likely to click than others. So why not go ahead and have the random server follow those preferentially? And we're also going to take a look at pages that have a very high in strength and a very low out strength. That's indicating that a lot more people are coming to this page than are ever going somewhere else from it. So that's a jump point where that's more likely to be someplace where a random server stops and teleports somewhere else. And I am completely out of time. So at this point, I'll just thank all my collaborators and open up to any other questions you have. And if you're interested in applying some of your own ideas to this data set, please see me and talk to me, and we can work something out.